Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with director, choreographer, Josh Rhodes. Josh is here having directed the Oslo Repertory Theatre production of Evita, and you will hear him talk about that production. You will also hear a review of that production and a song from the show. Josh's story is really significant because it points to the power of having people around you who encourage you to be the person you are. Josh was lucky enough to have parents and mentors who saw his passion for dance, for acting, for stories, for theater, and encouraged him, taught him, supported him, and helped him to become the incredibly talented and successful person that he has become. It's a lovely story. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are, not the person you think you're supposed to be, not the person other people told you you should be, not the person other people told you you were. So many people in childhood get told what they are. You're so stubborn. You're so smart. You're a success. You're a failure. And unfortunately, in childhood, we take those messages on and we run with them. We believe them, even. And so it is possible for a person to come into adulthood without really knowing who they are. So in my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And in this interview with Josh, you hear in neon what it's like to be who you really are. A man who at 5 was attracted to, drawn to, the musicals that his parents had records for. And that passion stayed with him. And as you will hear, and as I said in the run-up, he was lucky enough to have a family who saw what he was attracted to and didn't say, no, 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 don't do that. They said, oh, you want that? Well, we'll give you a little more of that and a little more of that and a little more of that. And then mentors who also saw his need, his passion, and nurtured it. So I'm not going to say any more about Josh's story because he tells it so much better than I do. But I will say, if you want to talk to me, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. And now, here is the talented, charming, funny, lucky Josh Rhodes. Okay, so I'm here with Josh Rhodes, and which is this, 4?
This is the sixth show I've done here at the Oslo.
Yes, right. And so he has directed Evita for the Oslo Repertory Theater.
Yes.
So I want to talk about Evita, but I only ask one question.
What, that's it?
Yeah.
What is it?
Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. It clearly is you. And the art to which you have given your life and are making your living, would you say it's theater? Would you say it started with dance? What would you say?
I would say musical theater.
Musical theater, always.
Because that sort of encompasses my passion for storytelling in dance, in song, with plays. I think musical theater to me is probably the best way to describe what my passion is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even if it's a play that I'm doing, I think what I learned, how I learned my craft was being obsessed with musical theater.
Well, wait a second, because I'm going to get there.
Okay.
So my question is, the only question I ask is, do you remember and can you tell me the very first time musical theater, dance, stories, any of that drew you, seemed interesting to you?
Yes, I think it was when I was really young. My parents had albums of musicals in their collection.
Ah.
And I stumbled upon Oklahoma.
About how old?
Oh gosh, very young, probably 5.
Wow.
I remember Sound of Music and Oklahoma.
So are you saying that they would play these records?
No, I found them.
You're kidding.
They didn't play. I don't ever remember them playing musical theater, but they had those albums. You know, there was in the 60s, people bought musical theater albums.
They did.
They had West Side Story. They had Sound of Music. And I think my dad was also part of one of those Columbia Record Clubs.
Uh-huh.
And so I think sometimes they just showed up.
Right.
I never asked them whether they actually listened to them themselves, but...
wait a minute. Are you saying that this 5-year-old, 6-year-old, and you look at these and you pull one out?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Like you were drawn,
yeah. You know? Like, I think probably the art on front, everything about it probably drew me in.
Yeah.
I don't remember that being the case, but it drew me in, and I played them, and I couldn't stop playing them.
You played them, which meant you knew how to put the record on.
Put the album on, turn it on. I remember the lever where you pull it down and the needle softly goes.
Yes.
And you just...
You know, this is... I have trouble today putting the needle down without scratching the record.
Yeah.
You were 5. That's pretty amazing,
actually. Well, my dad probably...
Yes, he probably did.
That's right. Ruin his records.
Right, right, right.
But, I remember listening to Sound of Music religiously and Oklahoma. I remember trying to sound like John Raitt in Oklahoma. As a young kid, I remember trying to sound like that.
Did you sing?
Well, I guess. I sang to myself.
Yes.
And you know, the musical that changed my life, the album that changed my life, is because my parents would watch me listen to musicals. And when I was a kid, this little musical happened called Annie. And, you know, for kids, it was sort of, at the time, it was The Wicked.
Yes.
You know, like, every kid knew Annie.
Right.
People can't quite believe that, you know, but there was a time when that was the one. That was the one that was in everybody's household. And I think I was given it as a gift for my birthday.
To see it, you mean?
No, to listen to
listen
it.
Listen to it. Oh, my goodness.
And it really changed. As much as I loved my Sound of Music and my Oklahoma, Annie felt like my musical.
Wow.
And it felt like, I guess maybe because they were kids.
Yeah.
Kids'
voices. You didn't have to pretend to be John Raitt.
No, I didn't have to be John Raitt.
That's right.
I didn't have to be Ado Annie. I could listen and I could sing maybe, and I was a little boy soprano, so I could sing with Andrew McArdle. Like, I always tell people that they're like, how'd you learn to sing? I was like, Andrew McArdle. I actually worked with her this year, and I was a complete geek around her because I just kept going, oh my God, you taught me how to sing. But I think Annie was the one that really changed my life, and my parents knew how much I loved it, and they...
I'm just curious about how old were you when this happened?
When Annie came on tour, I must have been at least 8 or 9 at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So they took me to Champaign-Urbana, which was a college town that was, north, or just near Decatur, Illinois, where I grew up. And they bought me tickets to the national tour of Annie.
They had no idea what they were doing.
They didn't realize the contract they were sealing
yes.
at that point.
The consequences of this kind act.
I remember specifically the show. Because I think my eyes I probably didn't blink, and I probably took the entire thing in. And I remember as the curtain call, it was one of those big sports centers that mm-hmm. they divide. They divide when a show comes. They sort of put up a fake curtain, and the national tour comes in. And when you go, you know, those sports arenas are always notorious for once you get to the parking lot, it takes forever to get out.
Yes.
As soon as the show was over, they grabbed us and ran so that we could get, so we wouldn't be stuck in the parking lot for an hour. I just remember them pulling me and walking backwards all the way up the aisle because I didn't want to lose a single moment of it because the curtain call happened and I just was enamored with the entire experience. I thought all of them were stars, and I remember my mom yanking me out, reluctantly out of that theater, and that was sort of it. I was obsessed with theater at that point. It was my first sort of, I can sort of say that is my first memory of professional theater, and it was my first memory of a story that really took me to another place. And I guess that's why I sort of still to this day feel like that's what I do is musical theater. Because Annie isn't just song, it's not just dance, it's a really beautifully put together story of using song. And for a kid to be pulled into that universe so fully, it's impressive. It's hard, musicals are hard. And so for the writers to get it right.
Clearly the writers get it right. I mean, Annie is playing somewhere right this second.
Yes,
you know,
for sure.
Right, so they clearly got it right. But I suspect that you would have been captured anyway by something.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
So, okay, so now you have this epiphany. It is clear that this owns you. Do you ask for dance lessons, singing lessons? Do you audition? Do you...
What I did is I auditioned for... I did school musicals.
Okay, we're talking about elementary school, middle school?
Elementary school.
Really?
And it was... And I... audition for community. Someone said the community theater is Theater 7 is the name of the community theater in Decatur, Illinois. And this is amazing, but they used to put on original musicals for kids.
Really?
Yes. There was a new musical written called Gyrant the Terrible Tyrant, and it was this story about this sort of oppressive, tyrannical king. And the lowly et cetera, which were the villagers, and an evil witch and dragon.
Oh my.
And the king in the end really wasn't mean. It was really the witch and the dragon who were keeping us all down. But it was like, but it had original music.
Yeah.
And it had original story. And it was in Decatur, Illinois. I sometimes think back at that. And I'm like, it's hard enough to get an original musical in New York City, let alone Decatur, Illinois. I'm kind of amazed that that was there. And I don't think I recognized that.
No, of course not.
Later in life that happened. But anyway, they were doing auditions and they needed children. And I went in and I sang Happy Birthday. Because I'd never auditioned in my life. I remember the room. I was terrified. I went in and we danced, and I could not dance. It was so hard for me. It was just at the convention of telling you to move your body at the same rhythm as everybody else. It all seems so obvious now that I'm a dancer. But at the time, the first time someone tells you to do it, it's actually quite tricky.
And you're what now? 10?
I am.
12?
I must have been 9, 10, because yeah. I started dance at 10. So what happened is I did this musical, and I went home and worked so hard on every single dance move. I just went home, and I can still do the dance on my fingers. I remember it, because I did it so many times to learn it. And my parents saw that I was just so dedicated to getting the dance right that I remember my mother was reading in the paper that there was a male dance teacher in Decatur, Illinois, and she just randomly, while she was doing dishes, I was walking through the kitchen. I remember the moment. She goes, "Hey, I was reading that there's a male dance teacher in town. Would you want to take dance?" Because she knew that I was struggling with that one routine. And I remember just very nonchalantly going, "Yeah." And that was it. And I met one of the greatest mentors I've ever had, Gary Scholl, who is still my dear friend and is always coming to see my shows, and he's amazing. He was the one, I walked into this dance studio, and I was the only guy. I was incredibly embarrassed and shy and nervous, and he took me under his wing and kept teaching me, and he was really good, because I came in and, you know, being a boy, what was this, 1981, being a boy in the Midwest, no other guys were taking dance.
Right.
I was very nervous and very self-conscious of being the only boy. So, of course, I said, "Well, I'll do it, but I only want to tap, you know, because I just want to do that." And he actually was really smart. He goes, "I'll let you tap, but if you take tap, you have to learn how to dance. So it means you have to take ballet." So I really didn't want to take ballet. But he made me. And I'm so grateful that he made me, because then I became obsessed with it. And I loved it. Just as much as I loved anything, any other part of musical theater, I dove in with the same passion and obsession. And I just danced and danced. And he was a wonderful mentor. And he knew and he saw that I had this passion. And he just kept teaching me musicality. You know, he was one of the first teachers who taught me choreography. He would point to the score and he'd go, "Look at this in the score. Something interesting is happening here. And you have to," and he taught me, he said, "You always have to obey the music. If the music does something, the movement has to match it." And amazing things to tell a young person who had no idea that 20 years later he'd be a choreographer.
Yes, it's really rather magical what happened in your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Well, you know, you depend on the kindness of strangers, but...
You seem to have depended on the kindness of circumstance. I mean...
Yeah, yeah.
You know? I mean, you just were led.
I was led, yes.
That's what it feels like.
But I had people in my life, though, who didn't fight it. They saw it, and they, instead of going, "How do I fix this?" they said, "How do I help this?"
I just want to stop, because whenever I hear this, I want to say, this is what makes the difference between happy humans and unhappy humans,
yes. You
know, is support for who you are.
Yeah.
And that's what you got. It cannot be overestimated.
Yeah.
I mean, you're taking you to see the show, that was a clear example of, we see our kid likes this, let's let him have it. Your mother sees you want to dance, so she says, "How about dance?" It's all... very lovely.
It's very lovely, and I didn't have to be forceful in my existence. I didn't have to fight for my existence as an artist.
No.
my dad is an electrician, and he knew that he tried to teach me things about wires, and he knew that I had no interest in it, but he would let me sit, but we were still companions in the workshop, but I was the kid going to the scrap pile going, can I have two of these and one of these? And you can't have that, and I would make weird sculptures. My dad would actually build something that actually works. Yeah. And I would just be like, look, Dad, I made a sculpture.
And he went, okay. And you would make art.
I would make art.
That's right. Okay, so I'm assuming you continued to study with Gary through high school?
Through high school.
And then you're going to graduate from high school, and you have to think about what you're going
to
do.
I have to think about what I want to do in college. And at that point, as far as mentors, I had gained one more very important mentor in my life, and her name was Maria Klott, who's no longer with us, but she was my piano teacher. And she was my voice teacher. I wanted someone to help me sing. I wanted to sing all the time. So I found this professor at Millikan University in Decatur, Illinois. And she loved musical theater, and she and Gary were both very exceptional in that they both saw that I loved this, and they also, I think, love musical theater so much as well that they love sharing it with me. I would go to a voice lesson, and then she would go, okay, this is Stephen Sondheim's company. You're going to take this album home, and you're going to listen to it.
Aww.
And then she'd go, this is Candor and Ebb. And this, she would send albums home with me, and I would listen to Flora the Red Menace, and I would listen to, became obsessed with A Little Night Music, and I became obsessed with Anyone Can Whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would get these cassettes, and I would get these albums, and I would go home, and I would listen to them, and I was given a complete history of musical theater without even knowing it.
It's the same thing. It's pretty magical.
Yeah.
I mean, other teachers would not necessarily have gone this distance to provide you with this. Do you know what I'm saying?
No.
I mean, it's really rather amazing.
And they both sort of teamed up together, and they called me the kid.
They clearly also saw the talent. I mean, it's not just that you were obsessed. Clearly they saw that you could do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, you haven't said it yet, but I can't imagine that they spent all this time and energy on somebody just because he was curious about it.
True. They probably saw that it was something I needed to get out, and it was something that I actually was getting better at.
Yes.
So they were so helpful in that process, and they were very kind and always giving me extra time and extra energy, and they sort of had a powwow, and I remember I went to my voice lesson, and Maria put an application in for college in front of me, and she said, you're applying to University of Michigan. She said, they have an amazing musical theater program. She goes, and you need to get out of Decatur. And it was just great because I applied. I went up there. I fell in love with the school when I saw it. I thought that I loved the way they spoke to me about my love of dance, because a lot of schools at that time, you come there and you say, oh, I'm a dancer. And they go, well, I mean, I had a lot of universities say, well, anybody can learn how to dance. Oh, you're really only interested if you can act or sing. And I remember thinking, okay, but I remember thinking, that's not true.
Of course not.
That's actually not true. And actually what I've been working on at that point for 7 years, yeah, felt like I really had sort of packed in some information. And so to sort of belittle it and go, yeah, you dance, but we're only concerned with people who come here who are quality singers and actors. And I said, well, I want to do it all. And University of Michigan was the only school that assessed our talent in dance, music, and singing, dance, music, and acting. They assessed all of it and had value and said that they value all of it. And I said, now if I want to keep this as a focus through your program, they said, oh yeah, there are ways. We'll figure out a way that you can still go to the dance school and get exceptional training and still, you know, fulfill the curriculum that we've provided for you.
Just God.
And I just thought, well, that's the school for me. Because your first question, what do you like to do? And I'm like, I like to do musical theater.
Yes.
I like to do it all. You know, I've had people come up to, when I was young, say, you can't be a Renaissance man. You have to learn one discipline. And I remember thinking, I don't think so. I think you can do it all. I think maybe I won't be able to be at ABT because my dancing won't be to that level, but I will be at some level that is correct for what I want to do, which I think is what I sort of, what I fought for.
Yeah, and again, you just got led. I mean, they said, go here, do this. You know,
I really did. They grabbed me by the hand and threw me. They were like, go!
Yes, right. Okay, so you're at in Michigan now. Yeah. You're in college.
Yeah.
So what?
So I'm at Michigan, and it's an incredible program, and it allows me to really look at everything I know so far as a dancer and a singer, and then sort of have these really great professors look at you and go, okay, that's good, but you really need this, you really need to work on that. And so it's an intense 4 years of just doing musical theater all day long, you know, because before, musical theater and dance were something I did after school.
Yes.
Or on a weekend. And so it was the first, other than summer stock, which gives you that sort of...
Which you also did?
Oh, yeah. Every summer, I was an apprentice for many, from 15 to... I was an apprentice for 5 years, and I would clean toilets, and I would help build the sets. I was a scenic artist one day. The one thing I could do was... I was a good scenic artist. I was a terrible technician backstage. I would, if you wanted something pulled in the right way, I would pull it in the wrong way. That was not my forte. But I was good at painting. I was good at cleaning. I helped, but I worked on the... I was an apprentice for many years. And so then when I went to school, it was like a chance to just concentrate on the craft all day long. You still have your regular studies, of course, but I was around other fellow lovers of musical theater, which I think is also an important part of your growing experience and sharing with other artists and learning, seeing all these people who come from all over. They're exceptional. We're all exceptional at something, and so you could sort of share and learn from each other. And I remember that was just such a very important 4 years for me. And it allowed me to move to New York with confidence that I knew what I was doing and I was ready for this.
So that's what you did. You moved to New York.
I did. I was planning on moving to New York. I graduated in 93. I was planning on going that fall, but I was cast in the national tour of Oklahoma. And so I went out on the road for almost a year, and then I moved in the next year.
What a shame.
Yeah. But it was so exciting.
Of course.
College,
oh, that's wonderful.
Tour, and,
yeah.
You know, it was
a little facetious, the what a shame. It was wonderful. It was amazing.
Oh, it was amazing.
Right.
It was amazing. And it was a bus and truck. It was one of those unbelievable bus and trucks where you get up, you get in the bus in the morning at 5 in the morning. They bus you. You get lunch. They bus you a little further. You get to the hotel, you shower, you get back in, you go to the theater, you have a sound check, you do a show, you go to sleep, the next morning, you do it again.
Oh, my God.
I could have only done that at that age.
Yeah, right.
But
what amazing training also.
Oh, my gosh.
Right?
Well, you know, it's like at that point, again, as for dancers and singers, at that point, the longest run of a show I'd done was like, the community theater production had 8 performances.
Yes, right.
You know, I'd never done anything over 8 performances.
Yes, right.
Because the really what you're in the business to do is 8 shows a week. And to have your technique has to be solid enough that you can actually perform and give the audience the same experience.
Yes.
1 week from now, 8 weeks from now, 9 months from now, 8 years from now.
Right.
The long run is really hard, but it's also what it's about.
Yeah, it's what you want.
It's what you want. And so there's, again, another learning experience of I'm sure everybody experiences this when they get into the workforce for the first time, just 8 hours a day. How do you discipline yourself to stay focused? And how do you discipline yourself to stay, to still be good?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't think it's the same.
You don't think it's the same?
No. No, I think at most jobs, there's a lot of downtime.
Yeah.
And you're on and then you're not on or you whatever, but performers, especially in theater, they cannot ever be not on. I mean, they are, because you're a human being, but it's what you said that the audience deserves to get the performance that they sign on for, that they paid for, right?
Yeah.
And so theoretically, although it's impossible to do completely always, that's the challenge, no?
It's the challenge. And it's also the, I think also when you do a national tour for a year, it's the first time as a young person you experience art as a job.
Yes.
And that is a really tough transition because before it's all been fairy dust and adrenaline and excitement.
Yes, right.
And, you know, cut to 6 months of doing the same show. There are days when you put on your costume and go, oh my God, I don't have the energy to do this.
Right.
And that, and what I say to young people now is like, they get a lot of times, you can sometimes take it out on the art. You sort of go, oh, well, this show is not interesting to me anymore. I'm like, no, this is actually what you're experiencing is what a great dancer who's no longer with us told me when I was working with him on Broadway. He said, don't let him fool you, buddy boy. This is blue-collar work. and I think what he was saying is you're only going to get so much art out of it.
Yeah.
And at some point, our job is to make the donuts. And our job is to put on that costume and make the audience think that this is the first time we're experiencing it. And sometimes that can be really hard.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It can feel like a little bit of torture when you put that costume on. But then of course once you get out there it's
right.
Fine. But it's hard to. I try to help young people through that hump because I know that hump, but the sooner you understand that your duty is a little tough, and that dance is blue collar. It is a blue collar job. Acting is as well. It's like working with machinery all day. You don't get to sit.
There's
not a day where you're like, I bet that machine will do it on its own, or as a mechanic. I'm sure I can do it without getting beneath the carriage of the car. You're like, no, you know what? You still got to do it. You still got to crouch. You know, my dad was an electrician. He had to crawl through ducts every day. And there was no way to do it without it.
No, that's
And
right.
I think there's probably the part of growing up and having jobs is just knowing that sometimes the glamour is gone. And that's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. And that's where you rely on your technique, your discipline, and all of your tricks. But as I think as a young person, it's great to do these tours, it's great to do this right out of college because I think it really teaches you the discipline to stay healthy, the discipline to give the same performance every time, and to experience all the gloom and doom that goes about when the fairy dust
Face. Yeah, when it's right. When you're tired, you know, when you're bored. Okay, so you went to New York.
So I went to New York. I went to New York. I was a dancer and performer in musical theater.
So you worked.
I worked. I always worked. I was very fortunate.
Yeah, you're saying this as though this is no big deal.
Yeah, I worked. I was very fortunate. I never had to have another job other than theater.
Do you have any? Well, I know you know how extraordinary that is.
It's extraordinary. I was very fortunate.
Yeah, it's not fortunate.
I think the years that I put into my craft before I ever moved to the city really helped me so that I could instantly join the ranks of professionals. And I got work. It wasn't necessarily Broadway right away, mm-hmm. but I got work and I was happy for it.
Yeah.
And I had great experiences. I worked with a lot of great people. I worked all over the country, and then I got a show that sort of changed my professional life. I got the musical Fosse,
mm-hmm.
The original cast. I'd worked with some people who were working on that project, and they said, you know, we're putting together a workshop cast for Fosse. You should audition. And I remember it was late at night. They were all doing pre-production, and I put on my nice audition outfit. And I went, and they'd already seen me dance. I'd already danced for them, and I went in and they sang. And all the singing paid off because they said, we need somebody who could dance and sing, and I got the job. And years later, it finally came to Broadway, and it was sort of my grad program of we took company class every day, We did workshop after workshop, and we did like almost all of Bob Fosse's catalog, which is immense. And so I think Bob Fosse was my grad program, and it made me a Broadway dancer. I was a good dancer before, but it turned me into a Broadway dancer. And then after that, it really opened the door for me as a career in New York. It opened up because I continued on to do shows for 10 more years. I was in 7 Broadway musicals.
Oh my God.
Wait.
What? So then you became a director? How did that happen?
Well, it didn't happen for a while. I was a Broadway dancer for 10 years. Then while I was dancing towards the last Broadway musical I did was Chicago the Musical, and it was a long-running musical. You talk about how long a show's running and how you have to keep it fresh, and how I kept it fresh is that I would be creative during the day. I would have another artistic outlet, and I would volunteer for any benefit. I would choreograph, I would write, I was writing lyrics for shows. I was doing anything I could to just be creative, because at night I was doing the same show. And I felt like I didn't want to be bitter for that. I wanted to be grateful for that. So I tried to fill my day as an artist so that I didn't blame the show at night for not allowing me to do anything different. And I really loved my time at Chicago. It was great. And they were very kind, and they gave me time off to choreograph. So how my career started as a choreographer, and I would get jobs at the Oslo Rep. And they would, I was still in Chicago the Musical when I came here to do this.
Really?
Yeah, they gave me time off. I would go, I would choreograph the show, then I'd come back, and then I started getting more work and more work. And finally, Walter Bobby, the director, called me and said, "Josh, I can't keep giving you leaves of absence. You have to jump. It's time. You're a choreographer." And that's really hard to hear. One, young Josh got into this business to perform.
Right.
I don't think there was anything that was going to make me give that up for anything if I could do both. And he goes, "I did the same thing. I was a performer. And at some point you have to say it's time."
Well, because dance has a shelf life.
It certainly does. It certainly does. But, you know, I definitely could have stayed in Chicago and done that for many more years and been very happy. But I had these great opportunities that I knew in my heart I couldn't not do it. So, and I felt like I was good at it too. So,
well, and again, somebody says, "You do this now."
Yes.
It's amazing. Yes, it is.
And Walter is now a dear friend of mine because he hired me as a choreographer for the Broadway musical Bright Star that we just did this last year.
Oh my God.
So he's a dear friend of mine, and I always tell him, like, "Walter, I jumped into this because of you."
Right.
He was the one person who said, and you know, he goes, "No, I'd seen your work and I knew you were talented and I knew it's time for you to go. It's like, stop this. Stop kind of doing it."
Yes.
And he goes, "If you actually do it, you'll actually get work." And he was right. You open yourself up to any job, as opposed to when you're in a Broadway musical, you're like, "Well, I'll only take the really good ones because I don't want to give up my night job." And so finally, by giving up my night job, my career opened up as a choreographer. And and I'm so grateful that I did it because I started getting more work. I started getting a name. And then I was hired to do my first Broadway musical as a choreographer with Cinderella the Musical.
Uh-huh.
I was given an audition, and I brought in a cast of dancers, and I put together what I thought a few numbers would look like. And the producers and the writers all showed up. They all looked at it, and they said, "We're gonna decide. We have a couple more people we're looking at." And I was doing Yentl here at the Oslo Rep, and I was in the Mertz rehearsal room when I got the call.
Oh my God!
And I was like, "Oh my God, I'm gonna be a Broadway choreographer."
I didn't know that they auditioned choreographers that way.
Sometimes.
Wow.
Well, sometimes as a young choreographer.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense.
You're grateful for it because it's, I think, the only way that, you know, because there's so many choreographers
right.
that have, that you go, "Oh, I know what they do because I saw this show.
Right.
And when you're young and you go, "I've been working like crazy regionally, but you haven't seen any of it," you're grateful to actually get them in a room to go, "This is what I would do with a Broadway musical." And you're grateful when they go, "I like it."
Mm-hmm.
You know,
No kidding.
Great. And, you know, Cinderella has been a blessing. It's still in my life. It's still the national. We just put up another national tour of it while this was going on. So it just continues. The legacy of Cinderella from 2011 is still going. It's great. It's been a wonderful thing, and it opened the door for me again, like Fosse did. It opened the door for me as a choreographer, and I choreographed. And after that, I choreographed First Date, a musical comedy on Broadway. It Should Have Been You, directed by David Hyde Pierce, which is a musical comedy on Broadway. And then Bright Star, written by Edie Burkell and Steve Martin. And that actually opened the door for me more as a director, because it was the staging of it is very... It has a lot of movement and a lot of dance, but not a lot of pirouettes and not a lot of trained dancers dancing. So people saw that as the director's vision because of the way I moved the scenery around, and it's actually opened me up to a lot of jobs, and it's been great. And so I've been getting more work as a director choreographer this year than ever before, and I really think it was because of Bright Star.
No, it was because this is what you were meant to do. I'm sorry. It just keeps... It's an evolutionary story. You don't understand what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, you... It's almost as though after you found Oklahoma, you know, the thing had a life of its own.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing story. So, because I know you have to go soon, let's talk about Evita, which is the sixth show you're doing at the Oslo.
Yes.
And, why don't you say some stuff about Evita as though whoever's listening hasn't seen it?
Okay, so Evita is one of Andrew Lloyd Webber's and Tim Rice's, who are the writers of this. It's one of their great musicals. It is about Eva Perón, who was the spiritual leader of Argentina. She was the first wife to Juan Perón. And she is very famous because she was considered a lower class citizen. She was poor, she came from nothing, and she ended up practically ruling Argentina. And she was known as someone who was extremely ambitious, and she, as a female political character, she is still sort of revered as someone who actually pushed past misogyny to get what she wanted.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating story. It's an amazing musical. It's almost a pop opera. There's hardly any dialogue. It's almost all sung. But it's brilliantly put together to where you actually grasp the scope of her life through song.
Wow.
By the end of it, you kind of follow it just enough. But it is not as linear as a book musical. So it's high in concept. So that's why Michael Edwards thought that I would be good for this, because I'm a choreographer and a director, and for a musical like this that has such high concept, it really needs to be completely staged. Every single moment has to almost feel like a mini movie that is almost choreographed.
Wow, wow.
So that's the approach of this. So this show is this, so it's this pop opera about this very ambitious woman. And when I got the script, I thought, what am I going to do with this? And I listened to it, and I was very taken by how many times Tim Rice, the lyricist, used references for light and the sun and burning and shining. And light is a big part of her life. And I read it again, and I thought, this is the Icarus myth.
Oh my God!
This is the story of the which is really a tale of ambition.
Yes,
for those of you who don't know Icarus, it was the sun. The father made the sun wings, and the sun loved it so much he would fly so close to the sun, or too close to the water, and the father said, "Don't. If you can, these wings will give you flight, but you cannot fly too close to the sun."
Well, weren't they made of wax?
They were made of wax. You can't be too close to the sun or too close to the water. And which is basically, I think, just a lesson on ambition. Like, ambition is good, but you have to know when if you have no ambition, you fail. If you have too much ambition,
you
can burn up. I thought, wow, this is really interesting, because Eva Perón died at 33. So she has sort of grown to a mythical proportion. As most famous people who die young tend to get that. You know, Jesus Christ died at 33. anybody who's famous in pop culture who dies young sort of becomes something.
Oh, there's all the drug overdoses. There's Janis Joplin and
Belushi.
Yeah, Belushi. Right, yeah. Right.
It's like it sort of allows the ghost of them to continue and grow. And I think that's sort of happened with Ava as well.
Well, and in a way, they all burned out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they burned up.
They burned up. I mean, she died of cancer, but the idea of burning, of having so much in her life at such a young age and burning young, I just sort of thought this could be the Icarus myth.
Yes.
And so when looking for a new way to stage a classic musical, that was my in. And with Paul DePoo, my set designer, and Paul Miller, the lighting designer, and Brian Hemesath, the costume designer, and Sinai Tabak, the musical director, we all met a year ago, and we sat in Paul DePoo's office, and we discussed this, and we said, okay, if we do this, how would this manifest itself into a stage production? What would this look like? And we all collaborated, and we all worked on this, and so what I'm very proud of is that we have here at the Oslo Rep a really singular production of Evita that's unlike any other production that's been done, because we steered away from the original intention of the staging, and not the original intention of the book, but the original staging. And we sort of created our own version, and I'm really happy with it.
Great. And it's 11:28.
Woohoo! Just in the nick of time!
So as you can hear, Josh and I finished in the nicotine. He had to get where he was going at 11:30, and he made it. So we're going to go out on Sharon Leslie's review of Evita. And following that, I'm going to play the song from the show, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. But now, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that interested you, intrigued you, made you laugh. Something that will make you try and get a ticket to Evita if you can, because you really shouldn't miss it. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too. In this genius production of the classic Tim Rice, Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, imaginative spectacle joins with richly layered performances to reach thrilling artistic heights. In the first minutes of the show, Evita descends from heaven, a billowing vision in white. In an inspired nod to Lady Gaga's performance at the Super Bowl, the Oslo is treating its audience to a Super Bowl theatrical experience. Musicals at the Oslo are always high caliber, but Evita goes beyond anything we've seen. This production is easily Broadway caliber because of three key ingredients: the vision of the director-choreographer, Josh Rhodes, the level of the performances, and the imagination of the creative team. The musical tells the story of Ava Duarte, the illegitimate daughter of a middle-class man and his mistress, who leaves her small town and becomes an actress in Buenos Aires. After a string of affairs, she catches Juan Perón, and together they rise to the heights of political power. To begin, you must have an amazing Evita. It's hard to erase the stamp that Patti LuPone and Madonna put on the role. Anna Isabel made me forget them. She brought vigor and a laser focus to Evita's ambitions, yet there was a warmth beneath. Isabel plays Ava as a woman secure within herself. It's only those around her who use the label saint or slut. The popular Don't Cry for Me, Argentina is a shining moment in more ways than one. Isabel has a radiant stage presence, a well-trained voice that holds up beautifully throughout, and an Argentinian precision in the dance, particularly the waltz with Che. As Che, Justin Gregory Lopez shows off a muscular edge and a boyish charm. His Che is less the iconic revolutionary and more the everyman commentator. His voice is richly expressive and his athleticism appealing. The waltz for Ava and Che was exquisitely conceived and beautiful to watch. Including tango dancers Junia Sevilla and Guadalupe Garcia as part of the waltz, adds a new level to the characters' interactions. Internationally known in Argentine tango, Sevilla and Garcia are worth coming to see on their own. Director Rhodes utilizes their abilities with gusto, all the while keeping the focus on the storytelling. Nick Duckart makes a handsome Perón whose appeal to the masses is easy to believe. Giselle Jimenez has a touching vulnerability as Perón's mistress singing Another Suitcase in Another Hall. Victor Souffrant's rich baritone fills On This Night of a Thousand Stars. The ensemble is terrific. Whether dancing, moving, standing, or singing, they become a sea of humanity whose lives are affected for better or worse by those in power. The Dark Set by Paul Depot III has cathedral-like proportions and features a long staircase that doubles as a symbolic metaphor. Brian Hemenseth's exquisite costuming is used theatrically to make statements of its own. The lighting by Paul Miller will keep your eyes entertained. And music director Sinai Tabak has created a sparkling sound with his orchestra. What makes this production gel is the vision of director-choreographer Josh Rhodes. His Evita is a fresh interpretation staged with expressive physicality and an abundance of graceful yet muscular dancing. The visual effects are often surprising and stunning. Evita becomes a tragedy of mythic proportions that has much to say about humanity. I bought a ticket to go back and see it again. If that's not high praise, I don't know what is.
It won't be easy. You'll think it's strange when I try to explain how I feel, that I still need your love after all that I've done. You won't believe me. All you will see is a girl you once knew, although she's dressed up to the nines at sixes and sevens with you.
Thank you.
I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance. Have I said too much? There's nothing more I can think of to say to you. But all you have to do is look at me to know that every word is true.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear